The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime contains depictions of violence and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised.
As we move to the south in a southerly direction, we have victim number two lying in bed, head in a southeasterly direction, apparent wounds to the head. There is evidence of ransacking to the nightstand just to the east of victim two. The bathroom is located off of the southeast portion of the room.
It was a season of death. By the time of the Wonderland slayings, Los Angeles residents had witnessed a series of murderous rampages, even as the term serial killer was being coined. Between 1977 and 79, cousins Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono were responsible for the rape, torture, and murder of 10 young women in the Los Angeles area. Victims' nude and posed bodies were dumped on local hillsides, giving the duo their name, the Hillside Stranglers. Before his capture, Skid Row slasher Vaughn Greenwood claimed the lives of 9 transients between December 1974 and February 1975. He slit the throats of his victims from ear to ear, leaving cups of blood and rings of salt around their bodies. Southern California, with its maze of interconnecting highways, claimed more than one freeway killer. William Bonin was convicted of the rape and torture murder of at least 21 young men and boys before his arrest in 1980. And necrophiliac Patrick Kearney confessed to the murder and dismemberment of 35 young men between 1962 and 1977. Many of LA's most notorious murderers found safety in their anonymity. In Hollywood's most infamous case, the 1969 Tate-LaBianca homicides committed by the Manson family, many clues were ignored or overlooked on the assumption that the killers and victims must have known each other. Violent crimes between strangers tend to leave few clues, and a serial killer may go undetected for decades. Some California cases, like that of the Zodiac Killer, have never been solved. But the situation was different for the detectives working the Wonderland murder investigation. The victims were all known felons, drug users, and dealers, with tentacles reaching deep into LA's criminal underground. These murders did not appear to be random acts by unconnected individuals. Within days of discovering the bodies, investigators believed they had pieced together the events of the early morning hours of July 1, 1981. They also had a good idea of who the perpetrators were. What they didn't yet have was a case they could present to the DA's office. The homicide investigators needed a witness. Because of her brain injuries, survivor Susan Lanius remembered only scattered details of the night of carnage. She couldn't give a clear description of the assailants. But detectives Tom Lang and Bob Souza had a palm print, and its location near one of the victims meant it likely belonged to someone who had witnessed or participated in the killings. From Wondery, this is The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime. I'm Tracy Patton with our writer-director, Larry Brand. If you're joining us for the first time, we recommend you go back and listen to the previous episodes in order. We'll be waiting for you. Today's episode, The Robbery. Here's my co-host, Larry Brand.
Lon Lanius thinks John Holmes is a joke. He might have the biggest dick in porn, but that doesn't make him a man. Hungry-eyed and desperate, when he isn't scrounging for the next hit of bass, he's sneaking around looking for something to rip off. He'd steal the watch off your arm if you gave him half a chance. Ron lets him hang out at the Wonderland house mainly for laughs. "Pull it out, donkey dick," he orders John whenever there's an audience. And John gives that pathetic look of his, but does it anyway. Whatever self-respect he might have once had has evaporated in the constant search for the next high. Lanius would quickly lose interest, and John would skulk off to the bathroom with whatever small rock Ron tossed him. Sometimes, to puff himself up, John talks about his friend, Eddie Nash, the nightclub impresario who calls him brother. Eddie's the biggest dealer in L.A., John would brag, as if Nash's stature somehow would rub off on him. And if they're interested, the Wonderland people, well, maybe John can set something up between the two groups. Most of what John says is bullshit Launius knows. He'll say whatever he thinks he wants to hear, whatever might give him some small edge. Still, Launius is not opposed to creating his own edge, and he's always looking for new drug connections. Occasionally, he'd send John out on some errand, pick this up from here or deliver this package there. Half the time, John would screw even that up. And you always figured he was skimming a little for himself. One time he blew an entire delivery and Ron had to beat the shit out of him. And John came back like a whimpering puppy, eager for another chance to prove himself. And yet, the idea of opening up a new connection with the likes of Eddie Nash has its appeal to Launius. Recently, the cops have been coming down hard on the heroin trade and the users at Wonderland are always hurting. Somehow, Eddie Nash seems untouchable. Word is half of City Hall is in his pocket. Using Donkey Dick to connect to the club owner might not be a bad idea. By now, John is into the Wonderland gang for at least a grand. He's always coming up with some half-baked scheme to get himself even, and always winds up owing even more. But when one night he mentions the guns, Ron Launius is listening. John tells him Eddie is a collector, his house filled with art and heirlooms. He might be interested in the set of antique weapons Ron recently stole from pet store owner Arnie Newman. Launius and an accomplice had broken into Newman's San Fernando Valley home, roughed up the maid, and taken the guns. They've got to be worth 25 grand, even hot, figures Launius. He makes it clear to John what will happen to him if the weapons somehow disappear before making it to Eddie's. If Ron and the rest of the addicts at Wonderland weren't in a bad way, he might think differently. But he decides to trust John. He sends him over with the guns and waits for him to return with Eddie's heroin.
Detective Tom Blake was being less than helpful. It hadn't taken long for the police to tie the palm print found on the bed rail above Wonderland victim Ron Launius to John Holmes. Earlier in the year, the X-rated actor had been arrested in Marina Del Rey and booked for boosting a computer out of a parked car. It wasn't the only arrest on his record. Back in 1973, he'd been convicted of pimping and pandering and given 3 years probation. A little nosing around revealed that the light sentence had been the result of a deal worked out between Holmes' lawyers and LAPD vice cops. Holmes would inform on his fellow pornographers, providing times and locations of upcoming shoots, as well as names of the principals involved. By all accounts, he had performed his function well. The arrangement had led to several good busts in the porn industry. Detectives Tom Lang and Bob Souza found out that Holmes' handler was Tom Blake in LAPD Vice. But when they talked to their fellow officer, he was still protective of his source. This wasn't unusual within the department. Rival fiefdoms inside law enforcement had led to confusion and delay during the Manson investigation. Lang and Souza made their case to Blake. However valuable an asset Holmes might have once been, he was now either a witness or a suspect in a savage murder with four victims. His palm print placed him at the scene the night of the murders. They needed to talk to him. Beyond his potential involvement in the crime, his connection to Eddie Nash might also mean his life was in jeopardy. Blake heard them out, but he had lost contact with the porn star a while back. He told Lang and Souza he would see what he could do to find Holmes.
Eddie Nash warns John about the Wonderland boys. Even though he freebases $1 million a year in cocaine, Eddie looks down at what he sees as an unruly band of misfit dopers. Heroin is different from cocaine, he tells John. These guys are lowlifes, scum. They might be fellow dealers, but the Wonderland gang is becoming better known as common thieves and stick-up artists. They'll just as soon hold up a rival dealer as forge a working relationship. Still, Eddie does like the small collection of antique guns John's brought over. There's a long rifle, a shotgun, and two Colt pistols. These are nice, he says, but what am I going to do with them? They're unique items, far too recognizable to be fenced. Of course, Eddie can keep them as part of his private armory, which means they're worth no more than what he's willing to pay for them. He sends John back to Wonderland with $1,000 worth of heroin. The gang can reclaim the weapons when they've paid for the dope. John understands what's going on. Eddie always likes being one-up in any transaction. It doesn't matter if it's a $1 million business deal involving one of his clubs or a minor drug sale to a nobody like Ron Launius. Yes, Eddie likes the guns, but he likes the idea of stiffing those dopers over at Wonderland even more. Maybe they'll get the guns back if they ever manage to scrape together the $1,000 they owe for the heroin. And maybe Eddie will find a way to keep them anyway. What's most important to Eddie is winning. It's impossible to tell if Launius's rage is more about being stiffed by Eddie Nash or from the withdrawal kicking in once he's used up the small amount of heroin the club owner deigned to send over. John flinches, expecting to be hit every time the Wonderland gang leader launches into a new tirade. If Eddie Nash is driven by gaining the upper hand in a business deal, Ron Launius recoils at the thought of being made anyone's bitch. Over the next few weeks, every time the Wonderland crew gets a hold of some cash from whatever burglary or robbery they've committed, Launius resolves to get his guns back. But every time, they wind up spending the money on more heroin and his plans are put off. Watching the cycle repeat itself, John hatches an idea, one that would put him back in Launius's good graces. Beyond that, he's been thinking of Dawn more and more since she left him for her family in Oregon. He might not be able to name what they had, but what he felt with her was different from what he's known with other women. Maybe there's a way to get straight with the Wonderland gang and make a score that can give him the new start he's been looking for with Dawn. When Launius and Deverell are alert enough to pay attention, John finds a pen and a piece of paper. He sits down at the kitchen table and begins sketching the floor plan of Eddie Nash's house.
While Vice Detective Tom Blake scoured L.A.'s drug-infested underground for leads on the whereabouts of his longtime informant, Detectives Lang and Souza continued to reconstruct the events surrounding the Wonderland murders. They knew from the palm print that John Holmes had been there. Its position made it appear as if he had used the bed rail for support with his left hand as he swung a heavy object down on Ron Launius's head. The striation marks on the victims indicated the weapon had been a steel pipe. But the detectives didn't believe John had instigated the attack. Nothing in his record indicated a propensity for such extreme violence. Whether he was a witness or a participant was still an open question. Hearing John's side of the story was crucial. According to the testimony of David Lind, supported by Tracy McCourt, four members of the Wonderland gang had driven over to Eddie Nash's house on the morning of June 29th. They had robbed and terrorized the club owner, then returned to their Laurel Canyon residence with the loot, valued at over $1 million in cash, jewelry, and drugs. Lynn claimed the plan had been dreamt up by Holmes, who had left the latch open on a sliding door, allowing access for the assailants. Without talking to Holmes, though, the detectives could only speculate on what happened next. If the murders had been revenge for the robbery, a robbery instigated by Holmes, what part had he played in the follow-up crime? The police went to Holmes' last known address, the Glendale home he had shared with his wife. But Sharon told them her husband hadn't been living there in months. She said he had come by shortly after the murders, told her he knew the victims, and had been to the house. But he claimed to know nothing about the killings themselves. He left without telling her where he was going.
This is going to be big, baby. Enough to get me straight and give us a fresh start. John grips the phone receiver intently, trying to let the softness in his voice convey as much as his words. Dawn doesn't say anything back, but at least she's hearing him out. It's taken weeks for him just to get her on the phone, just to let him hear her voice. After Dawn's escape to her family in Oregon, John called the house again and again, begging her mother and sister to put her on the phone. When that didn't work, he would send photos of him, of them together, along with notes promising he'd changed, that all he wanted was to hear the sound of her voice. Finally, she relented, tentatively taking the receiver in hand. Their first words together were awkward and halting. He was solicitous, the John of old, who would bring her silly gifts, who cared for her like no one had. "I just want to know how you are," he said softly. "I need to hear your voice." "It's good to hear yours too, John." He was careful not to ask her for anything other than permission to talk to her. And she listened as he lied about his life in L.A., about how he was getting back on track, giving up drugs. "I've gotten straight now, baby. Remember when I broke the pipe?" He reminded her of the time he'd run out of the cottage and smashed their freebase pipe, vowing to give it up for good. "Of course, but then," she says. I know. I'm sorry." Eventually, the small talk turned into penitent pleas that she give him another chance. Let him prove to her he was different now, would never hurt her again or ask her to do those things. "It was the drugs, you know that, right?" She wasn't agreeing, but she was listening. Today, when she picks up the phone, already anticipating it's him, he sounds different. There's an excitement in his voice as he tells her about a big score that will provide them with enough money to leave L.A. and start over. Wherever she wants, just the two of them. If only she'll trust him this one last time, he'll make things right again between them. Will she fly down to L.A.? He can pick her up at the airport. And then, in a few days, when the job is done, they can have the life together that they've always deserved.
Tom Lang believes Sharon Holmes still cared about her husband. During her interview with LAPD, she had seemed cooperative, yet revealed nothing about John's current whereabouts or activities during the events of June 29th and July 1st. Trying to figure out what the prim and proper nurse was doing with the freebasing adult film star was beyond the scope of Lang's investigation. Either she didn't know anything about the robbery and murders, or was simply refusing to incriminate her husband. In any event, as the couple was still officially married, she couldn't be compelled to testify against him. Sharon Holmes was a dead end. But evidence corroborating the stories told by David Lind and Tracy McCourt was accumulating. Gregory Dials, Eddie Nash's 300-pound bodyguard, had once been arrested carrying a steel pipe with bicycle locks hanging off it, presumably for added destructive power. It appeared to be his weapon of choice, brandishing it in one of Eddie's clubs where he worked as a bouncer. But the most significant piece of evidence remained John Holmes' palm print. It would be enough to file charges. If only they could find him.
John can't sit still, and whenever he gets up to start pacing, Launius orders him to sit back down and focus. Billy Deverell comes over to the breakfast nook, looks down at the piece of paper on the table. John has sketched out a floor map of Eddie Nash's house so the Wonderland crew can familiarize themselves with the layout. David Lind is over in the living room getting high on the sofa with his girlfriend, Barbara. The couple drove down the night before from Sacramento so Lind could help out on the job. Launius knew they needed the extra manpower, and Lind was a reliable Confederate. "Where's that fat fuck bodyguard?" Launius asks. John points to a back bedroom sketched on the paper. "This is his room." "And the safe?" "It's in Eddie's bedroom by the closet." The initial idea was for John to knock on Nash's door while Launius and Lind hid in the bushes, ready to rush in behind him. But John had nixed that plan. Bodyguard Gregory Dials always answered the door, and he was armed, usually with a shotgun. Unless they wanted to shoot it out then and there, they needed to use stealth. When John mentions a sliding glass door to one of the back bedrooms, the plan begins to center around it. John will visit his trusted friend to score enough base for a few hours' worth of high. Nothing in that would arouse suspicion. At some point in the evening, he would excuse himself to go to the bathroom. He'd sneak into the bedroom and unlock the sliding door. Then he'd tell Eddie he was crashing for the night and head back to Wonderland to give Launius the go-ahead. John is pleased with his plan. He knows about the Wonderland gang's reputation for pulling off armed robberies, sometimes of rival drug dealers. Launius is famously cool under pressure, and Lind would add needed muscle. Since Nash has never met any of them, there's no need to wear masks. John is heavily into the Wonderland gang for the dope they fronted him. Not to mention Launius is still angry over the job John bungled. But whatever his debt to Wonderland, it's nothing compared to what he owes Eddie. Once this job is done, he'll have worked off his debt to Launius and be able to pay back Eddie with his own money. He'll also be in for a good piece of the cocaine the robbery should yield. That he'll be betraying the man who calls him brother is beside the point. Eddie is all about business, and John can almost convince himself the club owner would understand. This is about business, too. Don't forget the China White, John reminds Launius. He keeps a vial of it in a dresser drawer in the bedroom. You said there's jewelry. Piles of it, says John, everywhere you look. Launius nods and smiles that evil smile of his. And I want my fucking guns back. Then he hands John $400 to cover whatever cocaine he's going to smoke at Eddie's tonight. Go get him, Donkey Dick, he grins, watching as John pockets the cash and leaves the house.
A staging area had been set up at the far end of the parking lot, out of view of the front motel room windows. Few words were spoken. There was no drama. This was the kind of operation they'd all been through dozens of times. The uniformed officers leading the way donned bulletproof vests. They clicked off the safety on their semi-automatic pistols. The suspect was not known to be armed, but was wanted in connection with four brutal homicides. No one was taking chances, and overwhelming force was procedure for LAPD. It protected cop and criminal alike. The tactical team divided and moved silently to either side of the flimsy motel room door. In an instant, the door was breached. Several officers burst into the room, weapons raised, shouting for the occupants not to move. Their suspect looked up at them, startled blue eyes, wild under a mat of curly brown hair. A skinny young girl stared at them from the bed, uncomprehending. And then it was over. John Holmes, a.k.a. Johnny Wadd, a.k.a. the King of Porn, was taken into custody without incident.
If John seems jumpier than usual tonight, Eddie Nash is too far gone to notice. He's been up for 10 days freebasing and can't concentrate on anything beyond the glowing white mass and the glass pipe in front of him. When John showed up earlier in the evening with $400, Eddie tossed him a few rocks that would cover it. Both men knew John owed far more than that. Both understood tonight's freebasing would go well beyond the few dollars John had scrounged, only adding to his mountain of debt. It was a game they played, pushing off consequences into an unknown future while they enjoyed the high of the moment. At one point in the evening, John brings up the antique guns. Launius was getting really angry, and maybe Eddie should consider sending them back. You know, John looks away as if it's all casual. Maybe you should just let him have the guns. Huh? What? Guns? Eddie coughed up a lungful. The ones I brought over that time. If it's a half-hearted attempt to abort the planned robbery, it has no effect. Eddie's barely paying attention. When he focuses for a few seconds on what John is saying, he blows it off with a wave of his hand. Those junkies owe me. Fuck them. I'm keeping the guns. They're too good for those lowlifes anyway. Eddie draws in the cloudy white vapor and falls back into the sofa cushions. When John excuses himself to go to the bathroom, Eddie barely looks up. John's main concern is Gregory Dials. If the bodyguard spots him sneaking around the house, it could mean trouble. Of course, John being John, the assumption would be he's looking for something to steal. John also remembers the two-way mirrors, though Eddie is in no condition to be playing Peeping Tom right now. John can hear Dials puttering around in the kitchen and seizes the opportunity. He slips into the guest bedroom and over to the sliding glass door. He flicks the latch and gives the door a tug, making sure it's unlocked. When he returns to the living room, Eddie opens his eyes vaguely and announces he's going to bed. John joins him in a last hit off the pipe before heading back to Laurel Canyon. By the time John gets back to Wonderland, there's a problem. Launius, Deverell, and McCourt are out cold. They've been shooting heroin all night and can't be roused. John spends the next few hours pacing nervously, scraping residue off the steel mesh pipe bowl and re-smoking it until nothing but ash remains. Several times he leaves the house, gets in his car, and drives back to Eddie's, sneaking around back to make sure the sliding door is still unlatched. It's 3 hours before the Wonderland Gang is ready to roll. By now, the sun is up on another stifling California morning. John makes his last trip to Studio City just after 8. Eddie's house is quiet. The door is still unlocked.
When Tom Lang and Bob Souza got word John Holmes had been tracked down and apprehended in a San Fernando Valley motel, they were relieved. The detectives had been concerned their suspect had already left the state, so this was a real break. They'd secured a bench warrant against him on charges of receiving stolen property. Only after they had him in custody would they reveal he was a suspect in the Wonderland murders. The lower charge might give the suspect a false sense of security, and he might let down his guard. They already knew from Tom Blake that John Holmes liked to talk, thought he could spin his way out of any jam. So they prepared to let him talk his way into incriminating himself by revealing too much. They still didn't think John was the mastermind, but hoped the pressure of a potential death penalty would convince him to give up Eddie Nash. They believed the club owner had ordered the hit in retaliation for the robbery of his home 2 days earlier. With Holmes in custody, Detectives Lang and Souza felt confident they were about to break the case of the Wonderland Slangs wide open.
Tracy McCourt nods up ahead through the windshield as John's Chevy Malibu approaches from the other direction. Both cars stop as they pull alongside each other. Launius leans across McCourt to yell out the driver's window. Everything good? John gives that stupid grin of his that always makes Launius want to kick the shit out of him. But today it means the sliding glass door is still unlocked. Get him, says John as the two cars drive off in opposite directions. When the gang's stolen Ford Granada reaches the cul-de-sac at Donna Lola Place, McCourt pulls to the curb and kills the engine. All right, says Launius as he opens the passenger door. Let's do it. Billy Deverell and David Lynn follow a beat behind, leaving McCourt behind the wheel. The three men push past the chain-link fence and walk up the driveway of the white stone house. When they reach the backyard, they turn, no longer in view from the street. Launius nods at the glass door. For once, the deadbeat got things right. The door opens easily, and they're inside Eddie Nash's house. Lynn now takes the lead as they cross the bedroom and enter the hallway. He can hear voices from further inside. In addition to his .357 Magnum handgun, he's got a stolen San Francisco policeman's badge and ID. At the entrance to the living room, he motions for Launius and Deverell to stop. Eddie Nash is sitting on a sofa, wearing only blue bikini briefs. Gregory Dials is walking in, carrying a breakfast tray. Lynn gives a silent nod to Launius and Deverell. Then he levels his pistol and bursts into the room, shouting, "Freeze, police officers!" Eddie Nash looks up at them dazedly and blinks. Dials turns toward the intruders, expressionless. "You're under arrest," yells Lynn as Launius and Deverell come up behind him, also with guns drawn. "Get down on the floor," Lynn motions to Dials, getting out handcuffs. As Launius pushes past him to get to Nash, he bumps Lynn's arm and the .357 goes off. For a second, everyone freezes. Then Eddie Nash falls to his knees, begging to be allowed to say a prayer for his children before he dies. The intruders look around to see if anyone is hit. The gun went off as Lynn was handcuffing Dials, missing him by inches. The muzzle flash left a powder burn on his back, which is now bleeding slightly. Lynn rolls the bodyguard onto his stomach and places a throw rug over his head while Launius hoists the terrified club owner to his feet and leads him into the bedroom. "Get down on the floor," he orders, pushing Nash face down onto the rug. Then he goes over to the wardrobe where he quickly finds the floor safe John told him about. Lynn and Deverell join them in the bedroom as Launius asks Nash for the combination. Nash shakes his head, though it isn't clear if he's refusing or still in shock, thinking he's about to be murdered. Launius grabs him by the neck and pushes him down to his knees. "Open your fucking mouth," he orders the club owner. Yanking back on his hair, Launius forces the barrel of his revolver into Nash's mouth. "You want to say a prayer for your kids?" Launius growls. "Well, I don't give a fuck about your kids." By now, Eddie is shaking violently, the steel of the gun barrel rattling against his teeth. "I hear you like to play Russian roulette," says Launius. He draws back the hammer of his revolver. "Like your odds now?" Nash mumbles something they can't make out. Lonnie smiles. Ah, that's right. Kind of hard to talk. Tears roll down Nash's face. If I take this out, are you going to tell me what I want to know? Nash nods and Lonnie pulls the weapon out, now pointing it at his temple. David Lind is still nervous about the gunshot. He leaves the bedroom and goes to the front door, peeking outside to see if anyone has alerted the police. Everything seems quiet. McCourt is behind the wheel of the Granada reading a newspaper. By the time Lind returns to the bedroom, the safe is open, and Lonius is hefting a half-pound Ziploc bag filled with cocaine. A small metal box holds a stash of Quaaludes. Devril remembers what John said about the China White and checks the dresser. Sure enough, in the top drawer is a large laboratory vial filled with heroin. Still, Lonius isn't satisfied. According to John, there should be more. Lonius tapes the club owner's hands behind his back and asks Lind for his hunting knife. Then he goes back to the living room and kneels beside Gregory Dials. "Where's the rest?" he asks, pressing the blade against the back of the bodyguard's neck. "I don't know," says Dials. Lonius draws the blade lightly across Dials' skin, drawing blood. "I don't fucking know, man." In the bedroom, a terrified Eddie Nash says there's more money in the attic. Devril climbs up the wooden ladder and finds a brown paper bag with about $10,000 in cash. At the same time, Lynn moves through the house looking for weapons. He finds Dials' sawed-off shotgun in the back bedroom and unloads it. Inside a closet are the antique guns. He returns to the living room where Lonnie still hovers over the bodyguard, threatening him with the knife. "Come on," says Lynn, "we've got what we came for." "Nah, they're bullshitting us. Let's kill them." "That's not what we said, man." "I don't give a shit about what we said. Fuck them." "I'm getting out of here," says Lind. He goes to the front door and signals McCourt to start the car and back it into the driveway. Then he runs back inside and looks at Lonius. "You coming?" Finally, Lonius lowers the gun. Devril cuts the phone lines while Lind goes into the bathroom and grabs a shower curtain, wrapping it around the antique guns. The three men leave the house and jump into the waiting car.
Film director Bob Chin couldn't believe what he was reading in the morning paper. It wasn't that the actor he'd turned into Johnny Wadd didn't have his flaws. Over their many films together, Bob had watched John Holmes turn from an affable rogue given to self-exaggeration into a junkie and common thief. Though they'd parted ways when John's addiction made him impossible to work with, Bob retained a certain affection for the leading man he'd also considered a friend. When he heard the news spreading through Hollywood like the frequent hillside wildfires, Bob couldn't say he was surprised John had gotten in over his head. The director felt certain it had to involve drugs. But he couldn't see the John Holmes he knew murdering anyone, let alone in such brutal fashion as what was being reported. Tom Lang also didn't think that Holmes had orchestrated the murders. But he knew that the adult film star was the common link between the Wonderland gang and Eddie Nash. And Nash was the one with the motive and muscle to pull it off. After Holmes' arrest, detectives questioned the girl, Dawn, found in the motel room with him. She either didn't know anything or wasn't going to tell them, whether out of loyalty to John or fear, it was hard to say. It was also possible John had given her limited information against just this possibility. The detectives tried to impress upon her the seriousness of the matter. This wasn't some minor drug bust. It was a murder investigation with four dead bodies. Still, she claimed to be unfamiliar with any of the names they threw at her: Nash, Dials, Lonius, Devereaux. After a few hours of fruitless questioning, they let her go. Lang offered to get her a ride home, but she seemed to have no home. The only place she could think of was Sharon's. The detective wondered about that, taking the girlfriend to the wife's house. But it wasn't his concern. He needed to see if his suspect would be more forthcoming. The detectives didn't think much of John's acting abilities. The star who had made Johnny Wadd famous made a half-hearted attempt at feigning surprise when told of the real reason he'd been brought in, not for receiving stolen merchandise, but for his possible connection to the Wonderland slangs. It wasn't likely the experienced thief and drug mule thought the half-dozen officers bursting through his door were there on a fencing charge. John admitted he'd heard about the murders. Everyone in Hollywood had. But he didn't know any more than what was on the news. When Lang told him they had his palm print, he pivoted with the ease of a practiced liar. He'd been to the house a lot, so of course his prints would be there. It was only when the detectives told him that the position of the print indicated he'd wielded the weapon that had killed Lanius that his demeanor changed. It was a game the cops had played many times. Everyone in the room knew John was involved, but John continued the charade. Lang knew from experience that it would go on for a while until John could figure a way out, construct a story that would account for the facts, yet still absolve him of the most serious charges. They left the room for a while, giving him time to consider his options. Then they decided on a change of venue. John Holmes, the one-time king of porn, might have been reduced to spending his nights in a series of fleabag motels. But he was about to start living in style again. Next time on The Wonderland Murders, Revenge. The Wonderland gang celebrates their successful robbery of drug kingpin Eddie Nash. Although there's talk of leaving the house before Nash can regroup, Ron Lanius decides to stay, certain he has the firepower to protect the house. The group spends the night doing drugs, unaware that Eddie Nash has found a way in. This is Hollywood and Crime from Wondery. Subscribe to Hollywood and Crime on Apple Podcasts, Wondery.com, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. To find a link to subscribe and for more information on the episode notes, simply tap or swipe over the cover art. You'll also see some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. If you like what you've heard, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and review us. And be sure to tell your friends and fans of true crime. We're counting on you to help us spread the word. Another way you can support our show is by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you want to hear more of the Wonderland Murder series right away, you can get all 6 episodes ad-free by subscribing now to Wondery Plus. Go to wondery.com/plus. That's P-L-U-S. You'll also get exclusive access to other Wondery shows, in addition to extra content and perks. The Wonderland Murders is written and directed by Larry Brand and produced by Rebecca Reynolds, Tracy Patton, and Jim Carpenter for Hollywood and Crime. Producers wish to thank Jennifer Sugar and Jill C. Nelson, authors of John Holmes, A Life Measured in Inches. Bob Chin, author of The Other Side of Paradise, the uncensored memoirs of Bob Chin. And Julia St. Vincent, director of Exhausted, John C. Holmes, The Real Story. Special thanks to retired LAPD Detective Tom Lang, co-author with Robert Souza of Malice in Wonderland. The Wonderland Murders was recorded at the Invisible Studios, West Hollywood, California. Executive producers Marshall Louie and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.